provided by the Litowitz Foundation in support of the highest quality programming to enlighten the public on important issues.
This month, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney take part in the final presidential debate at Lynn University in Boca Raton. What are the issues that matter to you? We'll find out Friday, October 19th, when the Florida Roundup broadcasts live from Lynn University in advance of the debate. I'm Phil Latzman. Join me along with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Florida lawmakers and top political journalists. Reserve your seat now for the Florida Roundup presidential debate special, Friday, October 19th at noon, and find out more at WLRN.org. And welcome to this week's edition of the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local and regional state news and issues affecting our community, our region, our state for that matter, with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week they are as follows. Patricia Mizet is a reporter who covers Miami-Dade government and politics for the Miami Herald. Well, welcome back, Patty. Good to see you.
Thanks, Phil.
And Patty, by the way, was among thousands of Venezuelan expats who traveled to New Orleans to vote this past weekend in the elections. And we'll hear her first-person view of that in a few minutes. Arian Campoflores mans the Miami Bureau for the Wall Street Journal, and he covers plenty of ground from Florida. In fact, pretty much the entire hemisphere is in his range. Arian, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Laura Eisensee is an education reporter for the Miami Herald. And we're going to talk a lot about education issues during the next hour with Laura and with our State Impact Florida reporter, Sarah Gonzalez. Laura, welcome to you. Good to see you again here as well.
Yeah, glad to be here.
We want your feedback along the way at 800-743-WLRN. You can also email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com or use the Twitter hashtag TheFloridaRoundup, and you can find us on Facebook as well. So let's jump right in and talk about President Obama's latest visit to the University of Miami, his third in the past 8 months and second in 3 weeks. He was at UM in late September for a Univision forum and returned there yesterday to try and rally the troops with his poll numbers dropping in Florida less than a month before Election Day. He told a large crowd in Coral Gables that Mitt Romney has gone through a remarkable transition.
Suddenly he loves the middle class. Can't stop talking enough about him. He loves Medicare. Loves teachers. He even loves the most important parts of Obamacare. What happened?
And that's what the Obama campaign is asking itself right now. A poll released yesterday shows Governor Romney pulling away from the president here in Florida. This is one poll. It's a Mason-Dixon poll that was conducted for the Miami Herald. I guess the Tampa Bay Times as well. It showed 51% of voters in the state planning to support the Republican. 800 registered voters questioned by phone, a margin of error of 3.5 percentage points. But what has happened to the president here in Florida? Arian, was his debate performance that bad to Floridians?
You know, if you look at the the polls this week, it's kind of gives you whiplash because we had a poll earlier in the week that showed Obama by 4 points. We came out with a poll a couple of days ago together with NBC that showed the race essentially deadlocked. And then the Herald came out with this poll today showing Romney up by 7. You know, the Herald poll suggests that the debate played a big role. Our poll suggests that the debate played a minimal role. So, you know, I think this just leaves a lot of folks scratching their heads. It's hard to know exactly where voter sentiment is. I would say both campaigns would agree it's going to be close, very hard fought. I don't think either campaign believes a candidate is going to win. Their candidate's going to win or lose by a big margin. And so, really, as we kind of go into this final stretch, I mean, it's sort of a cliche, but it really does boil down to turnout and who can get which side can most effectively get out their voters.
And Patty, we comb over these polls all the time. They arrive in our inboxes and we read them. And but do you think this wide range, this wide swing, does that mean that they're sort of not credible? Or, I mean, can we take anything out of these polls that we see every day that appear in our inboxes?
Well, I think more important than the particular numbers of any poll is just looking at the general trend. And the trend, I think, that we've seen since the debate is that the race has gotten tighter. And so regardless of which poll you look at, it just looks like more of a contest because Romney did so well last week. And so that's the takeaway that I would take.
Carmen Presti, she is an acute care nurse practitioner and a professor at the University of Miami's School of Nursing. She was among the crowd at yesterday's event to see President Obama, obviously a supporter of his. She says the president deserves a mulligan.
Well, he didn't give the best performance in the world during the debate, but everyone is entitled to a bad day, and I don't think that that really indicates how he functions as a president.
And it's just amazing that only 6% of likely voters in Florida say they have decided after the debate. But then we see the Herald poll says there's only 4% undecided. So have the undecided become decided? Have the decided become undecided? How many people do you think, Ariana, are really undecided at this point?
You know, I recently did a bunch of interviews with voters to just ask them that very question, which way they were leaning. And I found that virtually all of them had either made a decision or were firmly leaning one way or the other. You know, this polling does suggest that there is some flux there among a very small slice of the electorate. And so they, for that group, they can be swayed by significant moments in the campaign, like the debate that they already had, the first one, and the one coming up next week. But and if the race is really close, that will make a difference.
Well, this is a chance to promote two things. First of all, you heard the promo for our Lynn University event next week. That is on Friday, and it'll be a two-hour special of NPR's Ken Rudin, Mark Caputo from The Herald, Helen Foray from Univision Radio, and then Congressman Ted Deutsch and former Congressman Mark Foley, along with some other special guests, will be next Friday. And we should also tell you that some of these undecided voters this week, we've been surveying throughout the state of Florida in a terrific thing we're calling the Dispatches from a Swing State, and it's being done by our colleagues Kenny Malone and Patrick Farrell is a photographer for the Miami Herald, and you should check that out at our new website, by the way. It's been a big week for us at WLRN.org, and you can hear some of those thoughts of people either leaning one way or the other. Now, Laura Eisensee, we'll turn to you for a discussion about the education politics of this, and I think that maybe perhaps the people having the hardest time making up their minds between President Obama and Mitt Romney are educators, because is there really much of a difference between their platforms? And that might be stretching a little bit, because, you know, but is there a difference that you can see between the president and the governor?
Well, there are some differences, but there also are some similarities. So, you know, while Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he pushed for some of the same things that have happened under Obama's race for the top. So extra money for high-performing teachers. But one thing that Romney has really said is that he wants to scale back the U.S. Department of Education. He really wants to, you know, push for more vouchers, which is becoming a bigger issue here in Florida. So education is this kind of strange area where, you know, there's different sides, and then there's, you know, some areas of agreement. But I think in the areas of vouchers, there's a pretty strong difference there.
Right. So the Obama administration does not believe in the voucher programs that the Romney folks do.
That's
the difference. We're going to get back into education and talk about policy implications for Floridians and how they similar, different or similar on education with Laura throughout the show. And we've asked for help from you during the show from the Public Insight Network. We've got some great responses, and we're going to dedicate a whole block to education later on in the program. But you are listening to the Florida Roundup here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 if you're in the Florida Keys. I'm Phil Latzman, our guest once again, Laura Eisensee from the Miami Herald, Ariane Campo-Flores from the Wall Street Journal, and Patricia Bizet, also of the Miami Herald. And we're going to talk more American politics a bit later on. First, though, we'll talk the Venezuelan kind.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. You can celebrate modern Italian music and culture at Hollywood's Art Park Experience Italy on October 13th, 6 p.m. in downtown Hollywood, featuring Italian Hit Week headliners Subsonica and Negrita. Admission is free. Details at gohollywoodfla.com.
The Delray Beach Playhouse presents A Talent for Murder, an ingenious thriller in which a famous mystery writer discovers that members of her own family are plotting to have her declared incompetent. They quickly learn that it isn't wise to threaten a woman who has spent a lifetime designing the perfect crime. A Talent for Murder plays through October 21st at the Delray Beach Playhouse. Tickets available at 561-272-1281 or online at DelrayBeachPlayhouse.com.
And now we are back here on the Florida Roundup. We want to remind you that we want to hear from you along the way. If you've got a comment or question, you can email it to thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And we have phone lines open as well, 800-743-WLRN. And we are tweetable if you use the hashtag TheFloridaRoundup. We also have a Facebook page. It's the Florida Roundup on WLRN, where we take feedback anytime. And we also post all kinds of interesting links to stories and things we talk about. It's a very well-maintained page, and it is worth liking. Now, as promised, we talked a little bit about American politics. Let's hear what things sounded like in New Orleans this week. And this is the sound of thousands of Venezuelans now living in the U.S., many of them from South Florida, in New Orleans this past weekend to vote in their country's presidential election. And here's Carlene Hernandez, who spoke for many of them.
Even if we are out of the country, we have a chance to do something for our country. We need a change, we need new people, we need something new, different. Things have to be different now in our country.
Most, however, left New Orleans disappointed. In fact, only a handful of people, we understand, of the more than 8,000 that voted in the Big Easy went for the opposition candidate, Enrique Capriles, who got most of the votes. Patty, you were one of those that went to New Orleans and wrote a fantastic first-person piece about it in the Miami Herald. Is that right? How many people exactly voted for Chavez and for Capriles among the Venezuelan expats?
I think the final tally was somewhere out of 8,500 votes, around 50 or so went for Chavez. So, you know, the folks from Miami had been, and other everyone who voted in the Miami consulate was moved to the New Orleans consulate when the Miami one closed. So that's why there was such a big crowd out there.
And exactly, they closed the consulate in January. And what was the exact reason for the Venezuelan government gave for closing the consulate?
There was an issue over the consul at the time, and there was a diplomatic kind of snafu, some allegations there about spying and other problems, and Venezuela shut down the consulate, and so the nearly 20,000 voters from Florida, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas who were registered there were all moved to the New Orleans consulate.
So you did a great job in your column this week in the Herald on Sunday describing what it was like first person. Can you sort of just give us a sense here on the radio of what this was like for you to carry out this? Now, just a little bit on your background, you grew up, how long you spent the early part of your life in Venezuela before moving to Miami and now working here, obviously, but you're a Venezuelan expat and have dual citizenship, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think a lot of us felt that even though we had been transferred out of the Miami consulate and it would be difficult and expensive and to go and vote, there's no absentee voting, there's no early voting, it all happens on one day. We kind of felt the need to do it because if you don't take advantage of the possibility of voting outside of Venezuela, then there's always that fear that they won't let you do so in the future because, oh, nobody's voting, so why should we even open it up to the expats? So there's kind of this conviction of we have to go over there.
It was quite an effort, though. Groups like Voto Joven, we've talked about them on WLRN, done features about them, and just the amount of young people that were involved, people like yourself, people who don't know Patty's pretty young herself. She speaks beyond years. She speaks beyond her years, believe me. She's wise beyond her years, but there were a lot of young people at organized efforts to get people on planes and buses to go up to New Orleans, right? What was that like?
Well, what was funny was I flew on a late night flight, and it was full of Venezuelans. You know, there's like just a handful of people who are not Venezuelans. And the next day in the French Quarter of, you know, New Orleans, it was just packed with people wearing the Venezuelan flag, which is something that Venezuelans do very often. So in caps and just draped in the flag. And some got stopped by local folks with like LSU shirts and Saints shirts in New Orleans asking, are you all here for a soccer game? What's going on? And then on the actual election day, you could see the buses rolling in because they traveled overnight from Doral mostly to New Orleans. And every time they came in, people would cheer. And it was like a big party atmosphere, frankly. I was in line for almost 5 hours in the end.
In line to vote for 5 hours.
Yes.
And by the way, Doral, huge population of Venezuelan Americans, and also in Weston, in Broward County.
That's Westonzuela and Doralzuela.
There you go. And we think there are, about 100,000 Venezuelans in South Florida? So this is a significant amount.
I don't remember the exact number, but I know that we're up there.
So most of these folks are here because they didn't like the policies of the country when Hugo Chavez, a lot of them are here, we should say, right? Many people came here after Chavez took over, right?
Yeah, not all of them. I mean, there was obviously an influx of Venezuelans even before Chavez. And I think, you know, when you talk about politics outside of another country, it's always easy to be for or against something when you're not actually there, and which is why there's a lot of punditry, you know, overseas that sometimes you're like, well, it's easier for us to say whatever we say.
Right. But the majority of those here are fervently against the Chavez government.
Oh, sure. I mean, usually when there's events here, the votes, you know, like in this case where there was 50 or so votes for the president out of 8,500, they're very heavily anti-Chavez abroad.
So in your among your the friends and family and people in the Venezuelan-American community, there was a lot of disappointment.
Well, the flight back from New Orleans the day after the election was much quieter than the flight on the way there.
And I guess I was talking about the census figures, but what could this mean? Could there be more people like you and Venezuelans wanting to get out of the country that didn't vote for Hugo Chavez? And could that mean they're going to come to Doral and come to Weston?
That's been speculated, and it's a possibility. I mean, it's another 6-year presidential term, but it's not that easy, you know, to leave a country. I mean, this isn't just I'm going to pack my bags and decide to move to Miami. There are visa questions. There are money questions, work, family ties. So it's not like I think we're going to overnight see the doors open.
We want more like you. Come on. We need more Patty Mazzeis.
I came for college.
I'm glad you stayed. Ariane, well, you've covered this sort of peripherally for the Wall Street Journal. What are some of the geopolitical implications of this for our hemisphere besides what we just kind of talked about?
Well, I mean, you know, there's, Chavez has been sort of the leader of this kind of left-wing group of presidents in the region, and the opposition has got to be feeling very despondent because this was their clearest shot at bringing him down, and you know, who knows if they're going to get it again. But there's, you know, there are issues that he faces going forward. You know, there's the Venezuela's facing a lot of economic problems. He's got health problems, so we don't know if he's even going to, you know, make it through the end of his term. So I think there's probably still quite a bit of uncertainty going forward for the country and for the hemisphere.
Also, would seem to be good news for Cuba, which gets, I think it's $10 billion in subsidies per year in the form mostly of oil from Venezuela. And if Chavez had been defeated, that would have been in jeopardy. So certainly Cuba is looking
right
at that as
a critical lifeline for Cuba. And I'm sure that they're immensely relieved that he was reelected.
Are you listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN? I'm Phil Latzman. That's Ariane Campoflores. He's with the Wall Street Journal. Also with us, Patricia Mazzeis from the Miami Herald and Laura Eisensee with the Miami Herald. And we're going to jump right into some education issues as promised. Now, this week we called out to you through the Public Insight Network about what appeals to you about either candidate's education platform. We heard from Laura before talking about the differences, some differences and some similarities between the two candidates. And we're going to bring right now in Sarah Gonzalez, who is with our State Impact Florida crew, our award-winning crew, we should tell you. And you've been having this conversation nationally. In fact, tell us about the Tell Me More special that you guys had this week. And welcome back. Sarah, are you with us? Oh, I'm sorry. We should have given you the warning that she's not on the
line. Thanks, Phil.
Oh, there she is.
So
okay.
State Impact. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I'm sorry. Go ahead. All right. Well, we might have a bit of a delay. We'll move on. But Laura, I know that you actually monitored
this. All right, Phil.
This.
Are you hearing me okay?
I am hearing you. Are you hearing me, though? Yeah, no. So I tell you what, we'll go back to Sarah. Let's go to Laura, though. You had a chance to sort of monitor this as well. And there was a lot of guests, a lot of high-profile education guests that took part in this. And what were they talking about?
Well, yeah, there was U.S. Secretary Anu Duncan, the former education secretary under Bush, Margaret Spellings, Michelle Reed, and our local superintendent here, Alberto Carvalho. But what was amazing, at least to me, I was, you know, on Twitter, joining the conversation, was just, everybody joining Twitter and listening to the conversation and really hungry for this nuanced, high-level conversation about what is going on with education. And it was also really interesting to hear, you know, the local superintendent, Alberto Carvalho, along with very controversial former chancellor, Michelle Rhee. And, you know, Carvalho talked about how, you know, his strategy isn't just to, you know, shut down, you know, close failing schools, but to try and turn them around, which has happened here in Miami-Dade, Miami Edison, Miami Central are sort of the two highest profile, but also, you know, Miami Norland has been and Miami Gardens has been a struggling school. And this week, the principal made a prediction that they're going to be an A school this school year.
And we're going to talk about some other local successes and the fact that there's a bond referendum on the ballot in November having to do with education in just a moment. I think we are ready to go back to Sarah. And, Laura gave us a little bit of, she was listening in on that NPR Ed Chat, by the way, that is hashtag NPR Ed Chat. So Sarah, welcome back and talk about what you were able to participate in this week in this Tell Me More special.
Okay, Phil, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
All righty. Okay, so State Impact Florida, we teamed up with one of the NPR shows, Tell Me More, for a live broadcast and a Twitter forum on education. So we invited teachers, parents, students, basically everyone to join the conversation on Twitter, and we were bringing some of those tweets to our air. On the broadcast side of things, Tell Me More host Michelle Martin spoke to the Education Secretary Arne Duncan, education influencers like Michelle Rhee and Diane Ravitch. We had the former U.S. Secretary of Education, and as Laura mentioned earlier, Alberto Carvalho, our Miami superintendent, was also part of the broadcast.
Well, there's a lot of people on there. And what are some of the big themes that you guys got to during that broadcast?
I think the biggest theme was school funding and resources and how that affects learning. On Twitter, teachers were saying, you know, nowadays teachers in low-income areas are expected to have the same student gains as teachers in higher-income schools, and they kind of feel like they're being blamed and criticized when that doesn't happen. So Tell Me More host Michelle Martin spoke to Margaret Spellings, who is the former education secretary under President Bush, as well as the current education secretary, Arne Duncan, and here's what they both said about school funding and resources.
If we are serious about closing the achievement gap, we have to stop admiring the problem and we have to close what I call the opportunity gap.
What he is saying is we need to get serious about how we allocate resources. Sometimes I say if you have a PhD and loads of experience, you are at Cream Puff High teaching AP. And if you're in the inner city, then you have, you know, very meager offerings. Some of our brand new, most challenged teachers sent to do the hardest work, and then we're surprised at the results. So I think what the secretary and I agree on is we got to really get serious about closing this achievement gap, and that includes putting our money and our resources and our best teachers where our mouths are.
And teachers were also chiming in throughout this show about how students' poverty, for example, affects them, right?
Yeah, and you know, poverty is the number one indicator of academic outcomes, and teachers feel like that isn't really being considered when they're, for example, evaluated. So in Florida, teachers have said that the current teacher evaluation system punishes students who teach in low-income schools because and Laura and I have reported on this together, students in low-income schools are expected to grow essentially at the same rate as students in upper-income schools. And so teachers were saying on Twitter that the actual formulas for teacher evaluation deter teachers from even taking jobs in low-income schools because they feel, you know, it will eventually affect their pay.
Oh, and so those the people that you heard from on the NPR Ed Chat, and then there were also students that were part of the conversation, really kind of brought all these different parties together. And one student you heard was from Miami-Dade County, right?
Yeah, so State Impact Florida, John O'Connor and I, my reporting partner, we've been working on an investigation with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting into the number of high school graduates that are not prepared for college, community college, when they get there. So they have to take remedial classes before they can even start to take their entry-level community college classes. And one of the students that we spoke to was Shakira Lockett, and we introduced her to Tell Me More, and she was part of the education broadcast. She's a Miami-Dade College student, and she kind of closed out the segment for us. And so I'm going to play a clip for you. She talks about having to take five remedial classes herself when she got to Miami-Dade College and how that increased the amount of time she was in college and cost her a lot more money.
And with me, math has always been a problem. So by me going off to college, everything became a total mess. I didn't understand anything. And supposed to be on the test that I had to take to get into college, it was elementary math. And I don't think it was elementary at all. If nothing I learned in high school, middle school, nothing prepared me for that test.
So let's switch up the topic here at the end, Sarah. You've been reporting, as Laura has, on Amendment 8, one of the 11 amendments that's on the ballot in Florida in November. But this one seems to be getting perhaps the most attention of all of them. What's the big deal with Amendment 8?
Yeah, so we've all done quite a bit of reporting on this, and there still seems to be a lot of confusion out there. So here about what the amendment would do. So here's what it boils down to. Amendment 8, the Religious Freedom Amendment, does not have the power to give public funds to religious schools. A lot of school board members have spoken out saying this amendment would take money away from our public schools and give them to religious schools. If Amendment 8 does pass, public funds could go to churches and for things like soup kitchens and disaster relief efforts, but public dollars could not go to religious schools, not under this amendment. It would have to take a whole other constitutional amendment before that could even happen.
And Laura, what are you hearing about that here in South Florida?
Oh, well, the United Teachers of Dade and teachers are really out, you know, trying to, you know, advocate against this. They're very worried it would take money away from their schools. The Broward School Board actually took up a resolution. They voted, they took formal action against it. And what I think is so interesting that a lot of the conversation about this is related to education, but the word school is not even in the ballot language or education. It's all about religious freedom.
Yeah, it's interesting. Very interesting. And Sarah Gonzalez, great job. Great work this week on the Tell Me More special, the tweet up, if you will. And the conversation continues on Twitter at hashtag NPR EdChat. Thanks for doing this, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Phil.
All right. We had some, again, feedback from our Public Insight Network folks, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. We asked the PIN folks for their comments on this, and here's what we got. John from West Palm Beach writes, "Anything that gets the federal government out of education is a good thing. Between Romney and Obama, it'd definitely be Romney. In my humble opinion, the whole election system is flawed because it's top-down from the government instead of bottom-up from the consumers." So we talked a little bit about this. And Patty, you've been following these races. And by the way, Patty was also an education reporter for a very long time at the Miami Herald.
Back in the day,
when she was a real youngster, right? But what is being said on the campaign trail about how education matters like these are being addressed during this presidential race and during this election season?
I don't feel like they've gone into a great level of detail here. I mean, when I have gone to rallies with President Obama or Governor Romney, you know, if they're at a college campus, they'll make a big deal about Pell Grants and student loans and things like that. But beyond that, and when they campaign to Hispanics, they bring up education because that's an important issue for the average Hispanic voter. They talk about the importance of having a good education to achieve the American dream. And that's the kind of platitude that is usually made on ads and things like that. Greater the detail than that, not so much.
Stacy from Hollywood tells us through the Public Insight Network, she's an independent who's not thrilled with either candidate, but she writes, "Neither of the current two-party candidates is offering the right solution. Expanding charters, breaking unions, and races to nowhere are not what we need." Race to the top, this is another controversial issue. $700 million from the stimulus went to Florida, and of course, Race to the Top had some money involved there. $73 million to Dade County, $37 million went to Broward County. What about Race to the Top, Laura? This is something you've covered a lot, and there's always a lot of apprehension about who's going to get the money out of that program.
Yeah, actually, I've been thinking lately that I need to get back to reporting on Race to the Top because it is a lot of money and it's a 3-year grant. So the biggest impact we've seen so far is that last year, Miami-Dade used the Race to the Top money for merit pay for teachers. And we're going to be having another round of that. So about $14 million, if I remember correctly. And they're trying to figure out, you know, the way they're going to distribute that. How are they going to determine who are the highest performing teachers. And of course, the union wants it distributed to the most teachers possible. But besides merit pay, it hasn't been really clear. You know, I don't think nobody's pointed to, like, look what Race to the Top accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only about halfway through. So, you know, I think that's going to be something we're going to be asking more questions about, you know, how much did this really accomplish?
Now, Laura, the State Board of Education met this week in Tallahassee, and they made some very...
I think in Orlando.
Oh, it was what? You're right. It was in Orlando. What were the important decisions that they made this week? Because there were some things that I know I reported on. What stuck out to you?
Oh, they made some big decisions this week. And I think one of the biggest things is that they passed this 6-year strategic plan. And in that plan, there's two things. There's a lot of things that have been getting attention. Two things is that they want more students in charter schools, and they want more students using vouchers. So by 2017-18, they want 17% of all Florida students in a non-traditional public school, so a charter school or using a voucher. That's a lot of students, and that means that the charter school, charter schools are going to continue to increase in Florida. And the other thing that has gotten a lot of attention, not just here in Florida, but nationwide, is their goals for different groups of students.
Different races.
It's technically, if people are listening and they want to look at it for themselves, it's section 1.3 in the strategic plan, and it breaks down where these different groups of students, so Asian, American Indian, White, Hispanic, Black, economically disadvantaged, students with disabilities, and English language learners, and where they're currently performing in terms of reading and math, and where the state education administrators want them to perform.
So they've actually given them. They segment them out of the population, given them expectations as how they want to be performing.
Yes, exactly.
Does that strike anybody as strange?
I think it's gotten a lot of people really upset. I've been talking with some local students and educators here, and some people say, you know, it's not about lower expectations. So, for example, Asian students, the goal for them is 90% proficiency in reading. But then, Black students, it's 74%. And you see those numbers, and that gets some people very upset, you know, Representative Dwight Bullard, who's also school teacher. He said, this is just another version of separate but equal. How are you going to have different standards for different groups of students? And what's really interesting, one of many interesting things, is that Sarah earlier mentioned this, you know, how we're calculating teachers' effectiveness. Well, that formula is totally race. There's no race involved there. There's no economic indicators. But then when the state is making its goals for academic standards, all of a sudden race is important.
Right.
You know, so it's confusing.
All right, and the other big thing that happened, just to cap off the conversation on this, is from the State Board, they're considering how are they going to respond to this federal decision that, talking about, they're trying to charge children of undocumented immigrants in Florida out-of-state tuition And the federal court came in and said, no, you can't do that. And now they're considering what they're going to do next, because the federal courts obviously believe that if you're born here, even if you're a child of an undocumented citizen, you're still entitled to in-state tuition rather than out-of-state tuition, right?
Right. That's another big thing happening. And, you know, the federal judge was very clear in his decision. So I'm not sure how the state is going to, you know,
move on from there.
And the, you know, local educators, Carvalho, have really come out, you know, in support of, you know, these students are born here. They deserve, you can't discriminate against them.
All right, you're listening to the Florida Roundup. Laura Eisensee, we've covered a whole bunch of education things, and certainly you're welcome to join us if you've got something for us at 800-743-WLRN. Also at theFloridaRoundup@gmail.com. We're going to take a break. We'll shift back into some other stuff, including a discussion about foreclosures, David Rivera, other local races. Stay tuned. The Florida Roundup continues.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Verplu and Lumpkin, PA, helping individuals and corporations in coverage and bad faith disputes with their insurance companies since 1995. Additional information at 305-577-3996 or online at vpl-law.com.
The Lake Worth Playhouse rings in their 60th season with The King and I. The King of Siam brings an English governess to his country to teach his children of the modern world. Throughout the course of her stay, the governess tries to win the heart and respect of the king. You can witness the classic musical of Boy Meets Girl in one of the most romantic stories of all time. Tickets now available at lakeworthplayhouse.org. The Lake Worth Playhouse. There's something for everyone.
We're funded by listeners like you and by SunTrust, committed to helping you take the next step toward financial well-being. More information at suntrust.com/shine. We're also funded by Jackie Abraham Jewelers, a boutique firm where you can convert your diamonds, gemstones, and jewelry into liquidity discreetly and securely. With over 25 years' experience in Bay Harbor Islands, details at jackieabraham.com, where confidence is precious.
And welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. A reminder that next Friday at this time, we will be broadcasting live before an audience at Lynn University in Boca Raton, site of the final presidential debate. With us will be NPR's Ken Rudin, Mark Caputo from The Herald, Helen Foray of Univision Radio. We have U.S. Congressman Ted Deutsch committed to coming on. Also, former U.S. Congressman Mark Foley. We'll discuss U.S. foreign policy, which is the subject of that last presidential debate, which is coming up a week from Monday, as well as some other issues important to Florida voters in the election. And we do have some seats available, so if you are a big fan of the Florida Roundup, we'd love to see you out there at Lynn University. You can reserve your seat online at the newly redesigned WLRN.org. A lot of work has been put into that website, and we'd love you to check it out. And at the same time, also RSVP for a chance to see all those great folks and have a very lively two-hour discussion leading up to the debate at Lynn University. That, again, will be on next Friday at noon here on WLRN. Welcome back to the program. I'm Phil Latzman. With us, Patty Mazzei, Laura Eisensee, each from the Miami Herald, and Ariane Campo Flores from the Wall Street Journal. So returning to the political discussion for Patty Mazzei, David Rivera story. Well, it seems like there's a new David Rivera story every week, but where are we right now with the investigation, at least into David Rivera's actions as congressman?
Well, the newest information is actually that the congressman is campaigning now, as is his opponent, Joe Garcia. So they're both up on television and on radio. And it's interesting to see how this is playing out, because it's unusual, right, for a congressman to have had this much press about investigations and his potential involvement in the Democratic primary earlier this year. So the approach that the Rivera campaign has taken is to put out a positive ad appealing to non-Cuban Hispanics. It features a Colombian high school student who would be good for the DREAM Act.
We have that. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
Let's hear it, if we can.
Cuando enfrenté la amenaza de deportación, fui a ver a mi congresista, David Rivera. Él nunca me preguntó si yo era republicana o demócrata. David Rivera puso todos sus recursos a mi disposición. Así como yo, David Rivera ha estado luchando para ayudar a los jóvenes indocumentados.
Okay, so can you tell us what was said there, and who is that?
That's Daniela Pelaez. She graduated from Miami-Dade High School earlier this year and was going to be deported back to Colombia because her parents brought her into the United States illegally as a child. And thanks to congressional intervention, among other things, she got deferred action, so she got permission to stay and is going to go to college. And her congressman is David Rivera, and so she cut this ad for him where she says, he put all of his resources at my disposal. He never asked me if I was a Republican or a Democrat, and he stood by us, so now we have to stand by him. So that is the David Rivera positive ad that came out this week. And then there's also a negative ad attacking Joe Garcia.
Hey, guess what? We have that one, too.
How did I guess?
Here it is.
Joe Garcia raised utility rates on families.
He lied to us.
And Joe Garcia takes money from Washington's culture of corruption.
He's one of them.
Haven't we been through enough?
I'm David Rivera, and I approve this message.
So why the different tone in the ads there for the Spanish versus English language audiences?
You know, I think when you're in South Florida, you have a lot of different constituencies that you kind of have to reach out to. And so while the Spanish one is clearly intended to shore up that non-Cuban Hispanic vote, it's probably fair to say that the Cuban vote has long known Rivera, and he's kind of a known commodity there. The non-Cuban Hispanics who might be on the fence, here's a positive ad for you to get to know the congressman. To white voters or English speakers, so younger immigrants, it's a direct attack on Garcia. On his time at the U.S. Energy Department. And we've done some fact-checking on this, as have our colleagues at El Nuevo Herald. And, you know, the claims are not quite accurate. I mean, PolitiFact Florida did some checking in on Garcia's time in the Public Service Commission, which regulates state utilities, and the claims that he raised electric rates were given a false and a half-true later on because it involved different decisions that he made. There's an accusation in the ad about Garcia helping political cronies when he was at the Energy Department. That stems from a stimulus contract that was awarded to Puerto Rico and that Puerto Rico later awarded to a particular vendor that later hired Joe Garcia. There is no specific evidence of Garcia ever having been involved in this, and the Energy Department says the office Joe Garcia worked at did not award that contract.
But yet the issues that David Rivera is having when it comes to financing and raising money and all those other things that we're hearing, and the fact that he may have hired a Democrat to run against his opponent in the primary, which is coming out and he's being looked at by the FBI, that seems to be having some impact on the polls. Now, Ariane, you're sort of peripherally involved in this, but how does this resonate nationally? You think people are sort of paying attention to this congressional race, people finding out who David Rivera is and on the national scene?
Well, to an extent it is. I mean, you know, David Rivera has, from the time he's gone, from the time he went up to Washington, has sort of had this kind of cloud hanging over his head. I mean, the thing that really raises his profile is, of course, his relationship to Marco Rubio and you know, this superstar now of the Republican Party and someone who has been a close friend of Rivera's. So I think it boosts the profile that way. I mean, it is a local race. It is very much a Miami story. I've been watching it just because it's just been a fascinating sort of spectacle to see. But I think at the national level, what you've seen is the party essentially abandoning Rivera because of this, you know, apparent baggage that he carries with him. They're not, you know, backing him up with money. Rubio has sort of kept him at arm's length recently. He's in the eyes of many too damaged.
And he's got a new district to run in, of course, including most of the Florida Keys, or all of the Florida Keys. So Patty is the government reporter for the Miami Herald, and politics, you cover Miami-Dade County, and there are some races that are on the ballot. All politics is local, as we say. What are some other important races that you'll be looking at and you've been reporting on?
Well, I've been following a couple of Miami-Dade County Commission races where there have been a negative mail between Commissioner Bruno Barrero and his challenger, State Representative Luis Garcia. And then there's a particularly ugly race out in West Dade between two challengers for this open seat, Manny Machado and former State Representative Juan Zapata. And they're just trading accusations back and forth. They've been going on radio. There's mail. They've just gotten pretty ugly. And I think it's in part because it's so rare to have an open seat on the Miami-Dade County Commission.
And by the way, there's news from Palm Beach. And when we say Palm Beach and ballots, well, you start perking up a little bit after what happened 12 years ago. There was a misprint on 60,000 absentee ballots, which means that vote counting in Palm Beach County will be sort of special again this year. Here is Supervisor of Elections Susan Bucher.
The ballot is fine. It just did not include the titles for the retention of the Supreme Court justices and the 4th District Court of Appeals. We just want to point out that, you know, these races are on there and they lack a title.
So Bucher says each of these ballots will have to be examined to determine the intent of each voter. That sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Then the vote will be transferred to a properly printed ballot so it can be read by a scanner. It's interesting that what didn't print out was, or at least the titles didn't print out for the retention of the Supreme Court justices. Dum, da-dum, dum. Are we making a little too much of this, Ariane, or is this just what voting in Florida, what happens when we put ballots out there?
Let's just hope that it goes smoothly. Look, I mean, there's always going to be little snafus. The thing is, because of Florida's history of these, problematic elections in the past, to say the least, we always get scrutinized a lot. And so the sort of thing that might happen, a relatively minor thing that might happen in another district that wouldn't get a lot of attention here gets really blown up. But it's always worrisome. We've got to keep our fingers crossed.
Now, have you been doing any reporting on the campaign against the retention of the Supreme Court justices? Maybe you know a little bit about it, but why does the GOP kind of believe that these judges should not be retained? They're on this active campaign of judges are fighting back, and it's become very political.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not something I've been covering closely, but it's an unusual case in that you have the Republican Party basically coming out against the retention of these justices, and there's been a long time complaint amongst many Republicans that these justices are so-called activist judges and have made certain decisions that have really angered Republicans. It's this is really raising a lot of concerns among court watchers, even among some Republicans who feel like this is an unwarranted intrusion into the role of the judiciary. It's stepping over that boundary, the separation of powers. The Attorney General Pam Bondi has not sort of sided with her party. There have been other Republicans who have kept their distance as well from it. It's a really interesting thing to watch, because these justices are essentially having to politic,
yeah,
in
right,
a way,
and to protect the TV commercials,
and yet their
out.
Hands are sort of tied behind them because there are certain restrictions on what they can and cannot do. So, I don't know whether in the end it will work, but it is a really unusual case just because of the politicization of it.
A couple more things before we wrap things up on this edition of the Florida Roundup, and this is another important story that came out that I'm sure the Wall Street Journal is all over nationally, but Florida number one when it comes to foreclosures now. It's the first time since 2005 that Florida has held the top spot in that dubious category. The rankings for September are based on figures released yesterday by RealtyTrack. Within the state, Broward County has the highest percentage of homes going through the foreclosure process. There's Jack McCabe, who's a housing analyst in Deerfield Beach. He says the numbers don't come as a surprise, and he blames all of the flipping that took place several years ago.
We had 5 years of absolute greed run amok down here, and it devastated our market.
And he calls South Florida the epicenter of this type of behavior, which included exotic mortgages that depended on prices continuing to rise.
Even though it's 6 years later now, I've been trying to warn people that This takes a while. Real estate's not like the stock market. It doesn't fluctuate daily.
So I guess, Ariane, we've been expecting this because we've heard they're going to turn the faucet back on in these foreclosures. How much is it affecting the real estate market right now that that's happening, that we're now number one?
Well, right, as you said, I mean, this is something that, we've known about. With there are a couple things that are at work here. One is just the volume of foreclosures and the severity of the housing crisis that we underwent. So it's going to take a long time to kind of work off that overhang. Another issue is that the foreclosures in Florida need to go through a court process, and the courts have been bogged down in delays. There was a period a year or two ago when, because of the robo-signing controversy, when the pipeline was essentially shut down for a long stretch. So part of it is that it's just taking a long time to work off that level, that volume of foreclosures. But that said, even though it is a drag on the housing market, there are signs that the housing market is improving, that it is perking up, that we have hit a bottom. I mean, home prices have been increasing in recent months. Residential sales, the volume of sales has also been increasing. We're starting to see cranes pop up in Miami. I have a piece in the paper today about the return of condo launch parties as a sort of a sign of positive sentiment. Things getting better. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag, but things, you know, it's not all negative, this foreclosure news.
And the other thing that Ariane actually helped break was the story, we're not going to have time to talk about it, but the new television network that's coming to town, which was confirmed this week, that Univision and ABC will be the home for their new joint venture here in Miami. They'll have that'll add 400 jobs to the economy. I know the Wall Street Journal's done a lot of reporting on that. Worth reading. Laura, one final thing for you before we let you go. The bond referendum in Miami-Dade County, $1.2 billion on the ballot in November, and you say a lot of local governments are thinking about doing the same thing. A lot of school boards and districts are doing that, maybe thinking about bond referendums too.
Oh, yes. Nationally, I think schools are starting to go back to voters. And it really goes to what Sarah mentioned earlier. One of the big themes that we heard on the Tell Me More show, this need and want for more resources, more funding for schools. And here in Miami-Dade, they want $1.2 billion for school buildings and infrastructure for technology. Sorry.
All right, well, good, Ben. Laura, you'll be covering that for the Miami Herald. It is education reporter. What's your Twitter handle? Just give that out before we leave you.
At Laura Eisensee.
It's
Eisensee.
And Patty, let's give yours out before we say goodbye. Patty Mazzei.
At Patricia Mazzei, M-A-Z-Z-E-I.
Ariane, you're also on Twitter for those that want to follow you at the Wall Street Journal.
At A. Campoflores, C-A-M-P-O-F-L-O-R-E-S.
I'm going to remind you, thanks to all of our panelists, another wonderful discussion. Thanks, guys and gals. We'll be at Lynn University next week for our two-hour special, a great panel of guests. We hope you do RSVP at WLRN.org. And that does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, October the 12th of 2012. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back to it on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And again, it's on our Facebook page. The Florida Roundup on WLRN were produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Sammy Mack, and Elaine Chen. Our associate producers, our executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor, Caroline Brader-Watts. South Florida Arts Beat is next with live music if it's Friday, or only a game if it's Saturday morning. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida. Thanks for listening.
This is 91.